Racism affects so many parts of American life. Professor Enrique Neblett has been focusing on how it affects both mental and physical health.
I've, for a very long time, been interested in understanding how do race-related experiences, so things like racial discrimination, impact mental and physical health in African American youth. So that's kind of question one. How does racism and the stress associated with it impact health outcomes?
Plus, there are more recipes online than ever, not to mention Instagram. But are we forgetting some of our more classic Illinois treats? Here's Southern Illinois food writer Nikki Davis.
I think we go through trends, and we see a lot of that. And we're certainly seeing that just in how we're presenting food photos and recipes and those kinds of things.
That's all coming up on this Encore edition of The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to this Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What effect does racial discrimination have on the mental and physical health of African-American youth? How do we protect ourselves mentally against racism? Those are two questions that motivate Professor Enrique Neblett, Jr. He's an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at USC Chapel Hill, where he's also the lab director of the African-American Youth Wellness Laboratory. In March of last year, he was in Champaign-Urbana to speak at the U of I, and around that time last year, all young people all over the country were marching in protest of our nation's gun laws. One student in particular got a lot of attention at the March for Our Lives in Washington. Her name is Naomi Wadler, and she's 11 years old.
If there is a book that you want to read, but it hasn't been written yet, you must be the one to write it. I urge everyone here and everyone who hears my voice to join me in telling the stories that aren't told. To honor the girls, the women of color who were murdered at disproportionate rates in this nation. I urge each of you to help me write the narrative for this world and understand so that these girls and women are never forgotten. Thank you.
Again, that's 11-year-old Naomi Wadler at the March for Our Lives in Washington this past spring. With all of that in mind, I started by asking Professor Neblett his thoughts on what happened that weekend.
Well, I thought, wow, amazing, amazing, amazing. What a impressive, intelligent young woman who—
So poised.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. And invoking Toni Morrison, I mean, that's very impressive in her own right. But I think one of the things that was most remarkable about what she said for me is some of the reactions that I initially saw to the march were folks saying, you know, this has been going on in other communities and for a lot of people, and we haven't seen this kind of organization. And so for her to say, you know, here are the stories of some of the folks that aren't being told, and we need to tell their stories, it was encouraging to hear her voice give voice to those stories that have not been told.
And so your research focuses on the effect of racism, particularly mm-hmm. on young African Americans. And I wonder if we think about, in particular, if we think about health and physical health, I wanted to start by asking you about physical health and how maybe that impacts, for example, young African American women and men who see, I think especially in the past 10 years where we've seen so much publicity around the deaths of young African-American men who have been killed by police, whether that's Trayvon Martin or Tamir Rice or in Chicago, Laquan McDonald. I wonder if you can describe from your research physically, what kind of toll does that take on a young person's body if they're living with that kind of stress?
Yeah, that's a great question. My research actually tends to look more at the mental health aspects of racism-related stress. But I've been interested for a long time in understanding the impact on physical health. One of the things that has always been troubling to me is understanding why we see these health disparities later on in life. So shorter life expectancy, disproportionate diseases in terms of cardiovascular diseases, stroke, diabetes, all those kinds of things. And so lately I've been wondering, how does that develop and what's going on in childhood that leads to some of those things later on in life? I think part of the answer to that is that there's a mind-body connection, and the psychological toll, the emotional toll, the sort of negative feelings that these racism experiences sort of bring on leads to a state of stress. There's been a sort of discussion in the scientific literature about how the chronic experience of stress leads to compromised physical health. Racism kind of gets under the skin. Your body kind of, you know, has this exaggerated stress response that over time wears the body down. And so one of the questions we have in our work is, does the over time, the chronic stress of experiencing racism, feeling badly about it, the depressive symptoms, the anxiety that kids feel, lead to compromised physical health, which sets the stage for problems later on in life.
Would you say it's accurate to use the word trauma? Because it sounds like that's a little bit of what you're describing.
I think it can be trauma-like. I think that for many people, these types of experiences are things that have trauma-like aspects. So people are in situations later on that remind them of the event, and it kind of takes them back to that. People having dreams or nightmares. You know, we live in a time where information about shootings it's point and click. It's readily available. I remember during the time where, you know, the shootings have been going on for a long time. They still continue to go on, but where it was in the media and people were talking about how they would be dreaming about this, and they wouldn't, you know, it was almost as if they were there, people who weren't even, you know, at the specific incidents that took place. So those are what happen when trauma takes place, and I don't think it's a stretch to argue that there's some parallels.
As you mentioned the environment that we're in, as a psychologist, as an African-American man and a father, I wonder at what point, and I know every child is different, but at what point do you feel like it's important for parents to address racism with their children, especially if they're African-American or other communities of color?
This is a really challenging and difficult question, and it's one I get often, and I still haven't figured out a perfect answer. I think we've got to start early. I think, you know, kids are getting information about racism from very early on. I remember when my wife and I were raising our first daughter, reading a book about colors. It was a Dr. Seuss book that was published posthumously, and all the colors in the book talked about how, you know, the dark colors were the bad colors and the negative emotions, and it was difficult to read that. And this was before she was even verbal. And we had a conversation, my wife and I, about how the messages about dark being bad and black being bad, and many people have written about this.
And how pervasive that is.
Yes, being in the culture and getting into psyche from very young. So a lot of the scientific literature pays attention to adolescence and the effects on adolescent health, but I would argue that from the time children are, you know, able to recognize race, which some people say is as early as 2 or 3, that parents maybe aren't talking about slavery, but are making them aware of differences and making their awareness around race relevant, because it's something that they're going to have to, that's going to be a part of their lives. Is there a magic number? I don't know that I would say there is, but I would say early.
Early, and also it sounds like age appropriate,
yes.
Right? So it sounds like for you, the beginning, the important thing is just even just acknowledging as maybe as children. And I feel like oftentimes with preschoolers, I feel like preschoolers like to point out differences. Like that's a
yes.
Thing 3- and 4-year-olds like to talk about. This person looks this way or this person looks that way. Is that the type, is that the point where parents can maybe, I don't even know, how would you introduce it? Just say people have different color skins. Like what would you?
That's exactly what you would
okay.
say. There's an excellent book by Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And she talks about how it's never too early and that kids are going to notice differences. And a lot of times adults who are themselves uncomfortable with talking about race kind of shy away. And that what this actually does is teach kids to be uncomfortable talking about race. So she says, you know, when a child says something about a racial difference, have a conversation about it. Acknowledge that, yes, people have, you know, different shades of skin, that it's okay to talk about it. Because if you don't, you can send the message that talking about these differences is a bad thing. You know, last year, I think it was last year, the Charlottesville riots, my daughters are younger, elementary school age, but that was something that was so prominent in the national conversation and in my mind, my wife's mind, my friends' minds, that we didn't feel responsible to not talk about our kids. So, you know, we didn't sit them down, a younger kid who's kindergarten age, and start talking about racism.
Or white supremacists,
right,
or
right,
things like that.
Right.
What did you say, though?
Well, I don't remember exactly what we said. But
what was the tone? The tone was that this is happening?
The tone is that there are some people who think that African-Americans are lesser, and they're marching, and they're really angry, and we, you know, for the older kid, we were able to talk about how there are symbols and that this centered around the removal of monuments. My daughter is in fourth grade this year. She's studying civil rights, and, you know, there's been an intense study at her school on that. And so they're having conversations around what do these monuments mean, and we were able to engage it at that level.
And then I think about young people like Naomi, she's 11, so a year older than your oldest daughter, and is able to, as we're at this moment where children across the country are looking at issues like gun violence, but then looking at the racial disparity as well. And I think when you think about this young people at Parkland, they have been very deliberate about saying, this happened in our community. We are largely white. We are largely affluent. This happens more often in other communities, and we need to shed light on that too.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that? Do you feel like generationally, teenagers are more hyper aware of this difference? I feel like, in a way, I almost feel like they're doing a better job of having a conversation about it than most adults are.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me.
Yeah, I don't know that I would say they're hyper aware. I think they're definitely aware. It's a part of their reality. I think that we've seen the cycle. When you think about generations and generations, the youth are often the folks who rise to the occasion and say enough is enough. They're often our inspiration and help us to, you know, kind of push the envelope. So I don't think that, you know, some of these issues that we're dealing with may have a different face in terms of how they look. But, you know, these sorts of incidents in terms of shootings have been going on for a very long time. And the physical maltreatment of African-Americans and other underrepresented groups is unfortunately not new.
My guest is Professor Enrique Neblett, Jr. He teaches in psychology and neuroscience at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also the lab director of the African-American Youth Wellness Laboratory. And Professor Neblett, I wanted to ask you about, there's sort of, I think people say the talk, and they kind of put it in quotations, that is often something that happens, African-American parents or anyone who is parenting African-American, particularly young men, have a conversation with them about how to handle themselves around police or other people of authority. Did your parents have that conversation with you ever?
I don't remember the talk. I think my parents gave me a series of messages over time that sort of suggested to me that I needed to be careful. And so it wasn't kind of one moment in time, but even as I teach now, I remember my parents saying to me, you know, make sure your hands are visible at all times when you go into a store. And even as an adult now, when I enter any store, I always make sure that my hands are visible, that my hands are not in my pocket. You know, so I think that the messages were spread out over time. My personal story or experience is that I lived and went to a school in a predominantly African-American neighborhood until about seventh grade or so. When I went to seventh grade, I was one of the few African-American kids in my school. And unfortunately, I had an encounter. It was outside of school where I was followed around a store and harassed by the store owner and actually kicked out of the store. And this led me to go home and have a conversation with my parents about why was I treated that way. And it was at that time that my parents kind of said, okay, you know.
How old were you? You were in seventh grade.
I was in seventh
grade. So you were 14?
I was a little younger than that.
13?
Yeah.
Okay.
12 or 13. And that was kind of the first meaningful discussion. I mean, before that point, I had not, you know, been in an environment where there were folks who weren't black around. And so racism was a foreign concept. But being in this new school where everyone was trying to touch my hair and asking me about my afro and my flat top, you know, that kind of led to some conversations that didn't happen previously.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Professor Enrique Neblett, Jr., a psychologist. His specialty is African-American youth in particular and racism. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Professor Enrique Neblett, Jr. He teaches at UNC Chapel Hill, where he directs the African American Youth Wellness Laboratory. He's in Illinois. He's giving a lecture this afternoon at the University of Illinois. We'll tweet out details if you're in the area and are interested in attending. But for now, right now, he's on The 21st with me talking about racism and mental health, particularly among African American youth. Professor Neblett, so you were sharing the story of you having that conversation with your parents just before we had that break. I wonder if, I don't know how much more you want to share of that story of how your parents shared with you, but how important it was that you could have that. First of all, that you trusted your parents enough to have that conversation with them and that you were able to do that. How much of our support as young people when racism happens to us comes from our family, and mm-hmm. how important is our family unit in all of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't remember too many of the specifics of what was said. It was many years ago, but I absolutely remember that that conversation took place, and I remember that I had the support of my parents. And we know from research that we've done that that support from the family is extremely important. So one of the questions, and something I wanted to mention earlier, that parents worry about is if I introduce this too early, maybe it will ruin my child's sort of hope for the world, or that it will, you know, make them feel sad about the possibilities and the realm of things that they can accomplish. What we found in our research is that, at least for middle school, seventh grade on, it's really important to sort of talk about pride in one's racial group. But it's also important to highlight the existence of inequalities, to let them know, to talk about the fact that racism exists. There's actually research showing that if you only talk about racism, but you leave out kind of the racial pride piece of it, those kids, you know, have some negative behavioral outcomes. And so we know that having a conversation that you know, informs them that there are these racism is going to occur, but also gives them pride in their ethnic heritage, is much more beneficial. That same study actually showed that when parents don't say anything at all about race, those kids have as negative outcomes as parents who say negative things about being African American. And so this notion of not talking about race or being colorblind is problematic from a mental health standpoint.
And so that research, I imagine, is true not just for African Americans or for people of color, but it sounds like for people who are white as well. It sounds like you're saying.
One could imagine. We haven't conducted studies with our studies are with African American youth, so I can't say definitively. Right. But in general, I support having conversations and talking about race as. important. I mean, the content matters as well, but
right. And so that's a really. It sounds like you're saying that it has to be sort of a two-pronged approach, right? Because you can't just present the problem; you also need to present the solution as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what the studies have shown in terms of talking about racism is that there's kind of a sweet spot. At least there's one study that suggests this. So if you talk, if there are no messages about racism, that's not good. If you overdo it, and that's all you're telling the kid, you know, it's racism, you're going to have to try twice as hard, that may actually affect the child's sense of hope and belief that they can go on to do well. But if you come right in that middle spot where you sort of let them know that those things are going to occur, and you couple it, as you say, the two-pronged approach, that seems to help the kids do really well.
And I wonder how much your culture or your society plays a role in this as well. And what parts you grew up in New Jersey. I grew up in Miami, which is kind of the South and kind of not in a lot of weird ways. But I do think I grew up in a place where it was very diverse. And also it was very racist in a sense of like everyone talked about openly their racial differences and their racial problems. And that was something that's just sort of Miami is in your face in a lot of ways, and racism is no different. So it was a big change for me when I moved first to Michigan for college, and then when I lived here in Illinois. In my experience, I found that when racist things happened, it seemed as if people weren't really acknowledging them. And it was really strange to me. I was like, oh, so people don't talk about this here. And I wonder if you find that there are regional differences throughout this country in the way that that people talk about race also.
Yeah, we haven't looked at regional differences in our work, but there is prior work that suggests that the region of the country may matter in terms of the messages that are received and how parents talk to their kids about race. And of course, from a just scientific and psychological perspective, it makes sense that not all regions are the same. The context, the particular demands, urban versus a rural environment, are going to shape the extent to which these kinds of conversations occur. So, like I said, from my experience, this is not regional, but in an environment where I was, you know, it was all African American, we weren't talking about racism. I would imagine in an environment where maybe there are, you know, there's less, you know, sort of exposure to racism, there are going to be fewer conversations about it. But then you factor in different, you know, the South has a very different historical, you know, sort of legacy than the North does. And so that may enter into the equation, even though you may be in an enclave where there are all blacks, you know, there's, you know, bombings and there's a long history here. So those are the types of things one has to think about. There's some studies, sometimes people assume that the South, there are more conversations about race. There's one study that actually found that parents were actually more likely to talk about race in the Northeast. And they didn't, you know, sort of investigate why that may be the case. But there's sort of distinctions around how more subtle racism may occur in certain places and in other places it may be overt, and that may change the nature of the conversations that we have.
You know, we've talked about what families should do to talk about racism. I wanted to ask you about psychologists. I wonder if you think that psychologists are equipped now, if racism is part of the educational arena of psychology now, as we're training sort of the next generation of psychologists across the country, are we talking about racism and mental health in the community? Is it an academic community or psychologists discussing this?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. And in fact, training is a large part of what I'll be talking about this afternoon in my presentation. We are doing better than we have in the past, but we have a long way to go. So I don't know that racism and health is an explicit discussion in the multicultural training that I've seen across the board, but there are folks who are beginning to write stories about, or not stories, sort of get us to think about how we might work with patients who have racial trauma that's occurred. There's a lot of talk about the same way that we talk about other types of trauma and crises like suicide, that we might develop, for example, a racism plan. What do you do when you experience a racism stressor? Who are friends that you can talk to when you're feeling overwhelmed? By racism, those kinds of things. There's a group, Janet Helms, this is a racial identity researcher at Boston University, who developed a sort of toolbox that one could use. And so we're beginning to have those kinds of conversations.
Do you think college campuses are aware of this from a mental health perspective? As there's college campuses, whether they're have a diverse student population or not?
I think colleges and universities are certainly aware that these things are important. What we're doing and how we kind of, support our students, I think, is where we're still growing some. But if you look over the last several years, it's kind of hard to ignore. I mean, there's lots of protests and rallies at my, home institution of UNC. We've had protests where groups like the KKK have had rallies on campus. There's been a lot of, sort of discussion around the removal of Confederate statues on campus and the naming of buildings, all these kinds of things, which some have said really weigh on the mental health and the psyche of not just African-American students, but all of the students in the community in terms of the university being an inclusive environment. And so I think universities are absolutely aware. I think we're still, trying to figure out how we can support and validate the students in these experiences.
So I wonder, as we look at this and we think about the broader picture of this, not just mental health, but physical health as well. When you look at all of these studies, the studies after studies that show that health outcomes for African-Americans are simply not as good as their white peers, even if they have the same socioeconomic status, do you feel like we are looking enough at racism as being a systemic or a defining factor in all of this?
Well, I study racism and I study its effects on health. So if you ask me, I'm going to tell you, no, I don't think we're, looking enough at it. But all jokes aside, I'm glad that you call attention to a very important observation, and that is that even when you account for socioeconomic status, you still see these disparities. And so the question is, if it's not just socioeconomic status, if it's not just general stress, our studies show that even when you take into account kind of general levels of stress, there's still an added effect of racism, then what is it? The research actually would seem to suggest that there is some unique aspect or contribution that's contributing to the negative outcomes of these youth.
So then when we look at positive outcomes, how do you think we can work against all of these things from a mental health perspective? We often hear so much about mentoring programs and family support. What direction should we be looking?
Another great question. There are lots of different sort of protective factors that folks have talked about in terms of social support, mentoring, et cetera. I've been a fan in my work of thinking about racial, cultural, and ethnic factors that are specific to being African American as things we should look into. So how do we bolster African American kids' sense of racial and ethnic identity? How do we get parents, you know, talking to them about, you know, pride in their race? How do we teach them some of the values that we know from African culture have been associated with favorable mental and physical health outcomes? Those are the things that I think are important for us to pay attention to as we go forward. At the same time, one of the things I'm thinking a lot about in my work is that when we teach ethnic identity and teach folks to have a strong sense of who they are as African American, there may be a little bit of a double-edged sword there, because it increases their awareness of things like racism that are taking place. We absolutely want kids to have a strong sense of themselves as African Americans, but at the same time, that may mean that you are more attuned to, more vigilant around racism as it's taking place. And we started out this conversation by saying that that awareness can have a negative effect on your psyche. So I think we have to have a balanced approach in how we, you know, build our kids up and have them feel good about being African American while also equipping them with the skills to navigate these, you know, racial adversity.
That said, I wonder what you think about how this gets reflected in popular culture. You mentioned at the beginning reading books to your daughter. Now, you know, with the success of a movie like Black Panther, where I think we're seeing so much conversation around how much that celebrates, obviously a fictional African culture, but like how much it just celebrates that heritage. Do you think that makes a difference?
I think it has the potential to make a difference. I think Black Panther is awesome. I think I loved it. I enjoyed the film. And I think it's a step in the right direction. But I think we still have a very long way to go. You know, one of the problems with racism is that it's systemic wide. It's not just, you know, sort of person to person name calling. This is something that's in the air. It's a part of when we turn on the television, there are messages. Nobody's saying, you know, you know, such and such. The TV's not calling you names, but there are messages. There's research showing that, you know, even how African-American characters are presented on television, they have more negative affect and are more likely to be negatively portrayed. And so kids who are taking that in are learning that even though nobody is explicitly conveying a message. And so we absolutely need Black Panthers. We need these sorts of things. But it can't just be one movie or an isolated event. It has to become a part of the fabric of our culture and society.
Professor Neblett, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you, your research is focused on African-American youth. I imagine that this is also something that you see in other communities. I wonder, as you see sort of a growing field of people looking at Latino youth, or I'm thinking of South Asian young people, particularly young men, and how they're often viewed in this country as well. I guess there's a whole field here that maybe we maybe is growing.
Absolutely. The field is growing. You know, we as scientists like to be careful about making conclusions about groups that we haven't studied. So we always are on the side of caution. And most of my work has been with African American youth. But it would be foolish for me to suggest that some of the things that we see with this group have no parallel to other groups. There are similar experiences. Other groups experience racism and discrimination. We're beginning to do some partnering work with folks at UNC Greensboro and also North Carolina Central University, where we're looking at African-American and Latino populations in North Carolina and thinking about how these disparities develop over time. So I think we absolutely have to look at other groups.
That's Professor Enrique Neblett Jr., Director of the African American. He's Lab Director of the African American Youth Wellness Laboratory at UNC. Thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
This was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There's always a new food trend, right? And with the way everyone blogs or Instagrams or posts them to Pinterest, it's sometimes easy to forget the classics. But those classic recipes can be a way to remember our family, our friends, and even our roots. That's what Nikki Davis believes. She writes the Taste column for the Southern newspaper and also has her own website called Rooted in Food. She teaches hospitality and tourism administration at Southern Illinois University. And she's on the line with us now from Carbondale to share some Illinois classic recipes. Hi, Nikki. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Nikki, in your recent column for The Taste, you wrote about forgotten desserts. And I saw right. And I think a lot of these recipes date from a time before there were even refrigeration options in the home kitchen. So I think when we think about how modern appliances have changed the way we cook, why did you want to bring these forgotten desserts back?
Oh, these are desserts that are from my childhood, and that raisin pie there is one that we had every holiday, every celebration, and it's one of my favorites. So, of course, these are going to be the ones that I want to see people cooking, but more importantly than that, I think it's just important for us to be in the kitchen and cooking from scratch when we can, and I think that's a skill that is kind of starting to go by the wayside a little bit. We don't spend a lot of time in kitchens with our kids or our grandkids teaching them how to cook. So anything that we can do to bring that skill back to the family, I think is important.
Did you do that in your family?
Absolutely. I actually grew up at the knees of my grandma and my mom. All of my aunts were great cooks growing up, so I learned how to cook from them. That was my culinary school, and I learned recipes that had been passed down in my grandmother's German family for generations. And those are things that I try to teach my own daughter. She's 11, so we're just kind of now in that cooking phase and helping mom in the kitchen a little bit. But absolutely grew up cooking with every female in my family.
And how is how else was food part of your growing up in Southern Illinois? And obviously it sounds like it was something you all did together. Was this also something where you cooked for other people as well?
You know what? Food was a central part of pretty much every family gathering, every celebration, every holiday, church potlucks when I was growing up. You know, everybody shared recipes and we all, in fact, some of those recipes I would love to have now to cook and I don't. But, you know, beyond that, my parents owned a restaurant and my mom catered out of our home kitchen when I was real little. So that was, food was always around and I was always around it. My parents were foodies before being a foodie was popular. So even when we traveled, food and experiencing the food culture wherever we went was kind of a central part of that vacation. So I guess food's always been part of my life in various aspects, but the cooking is what I always come back to.
And your website's called Rooted in Food. I wanted to ask how far back your family's roots go in Southern Illinois.
My roots actually predate Illinois being a state. I'm sixth generation thereabouts. And my husband's the same way. His family settled here in the early 1800s, as did mine. We're both German primarily with a little Scottish and Irish mixed in, but you know, genealogy is a big part of my life as well. So we've managed to trace all of these histories back quite a ways. But my Scottish side settled near Pomona, Illinois, which is in the far south. It's a little bit more south than Carbondale. In 1815, and Caleb Lindsay was that ancestor, and he brought 14 children and several grandchildren with him. So I tease people sometimes that I can stand in the middle of Jackson County and throw a stone and hit somebody that I'm related to.
We're speaking with Nikki Davis. She writes, as we're talking about her blog, it's called Rooted in Food. She also writes a column for The Southern, and she teaches hospitality and food tourism at SIU in Carbondale. Nikki, how do you bring these ideas into the classroom when we're talking about tourism and hospitality? We've been talking about families and home cooks.
Sure. You know, it depends on the course, and we do teach a lot of food courses here, and we do teach a course that is specifically related to food culture. And that's a freshman level course, but open to anybody on campus who's interested. And that particular course, students get to experience culture and food aside from their own. But one of the projects that they get to do is kind of tracing their own heritage and exploring their own food culture. And that course started last year. It's relatively new, but it's been very well received, and it's something I think our students really are enjoying doing. Aside from that, we have a lot of students who are just interested in food media. We have students who write their own food blogs, do their own cooking videos, sometimes for YouTube, sometimes for things that we do in classes and in the program. We've also worked on outside programs. A few years ago, we had a project called Good Food Local that was actually funded by the Department of Ag. And we actually worked with specialty crop growers and took that produce and ran cooking classes all over Southern Illinois, trying to teach people how to cook with those specialty products. So food's kind of intermixed in a lot of things that we do in the program in different ways.
And I wonder when you're, especially when you're thinking about your students, I mentioned Pinterest or Instagram. Mm-hmm. I also, lots of people I think love to share these recipes where it's just a video of making something now, and they're just sharing the video of how to cook something. Do you feel like, do you think we're kind of forgetting about classic recipes, or do we think we're going back to those because they are kind of such solid, especially when we're talking about baking? I mean, I feel like there's just it's basically a base, a foundation of a kind of a couple of things that you modify.
Right. I think we go through trends and we see a lot of that. And we're certainly seeing that just in how we're presenting food photos and recipes and those kinds of things. I always want to have a recipe in front of me. I try not to just go off of the video that shows up on Facebook, let's say, but to actually find the actual recipe for that particular food. I think we're a culture, and I experience this. I'm a mom. I work full time. My husband works full time. When you have active kids, and certainly if you have more than one kid, we're busy. So I think we're always looking for shortcuts and things that help us make mealtime easier or faster. But taking time to get back to cooking Sunday pot roast, let's say, in the oven that takes 2 or 3 hours, if you can do that on occasion, there's some pride and satisfaction that goes along with serving that meal to your friends and family.
Mm-hmm. Let's go through some of the desserts that you mentioned as you're talking about things to make for people. One I'd never heard of was a recipe that you have. It's called funeral pie. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Funeral pie is a little bit from Amish and German heritage, kind of a mix there. And it's raisin pie. And it's something that I grew up with. And it was called funeral pie because it was kind of a go-to for like my grandma's generation and her mother and grandmother's generations, a food that you could prepare when family is grieving the loss of a loved one, in that tradition of taking food to the family to help them kind of get through the initial stages of that grief and that loss. That's something that I don't think we see a lot of. We see it in small communities. We see it within families and close-knit friends. But we don't see that tradition happening community-wide anymore like it used to. So hence the name funeral pie, but it's really just a traditional raisin pie.
And so by raisin pie, Nikki, is that kind of like a mincemeat pie, in other words?
It's similar, but certainly I a little bit sweeter, or at least mine is a little bit sweeter than mincemeat. But it's literally raisins and sugar, and I put brandy in mine. Not everybody does, but I think that gives a little bit, kind of lifts the flavor profile a bit, and some lemon juice and butter, and that is all it is. And it's simple to do, but it's one that I think we don't think about making. And probably people, you know, our millennials and our Gen Xers around us probably have never had either. Certainly something that I still find on restaurant menus here locally in Southern Illinois, but it's typically that diner that's owned by, you know, somebody local. It's not something that we find on chain restaurant menus by any means.
Mm-hmm. You also highlighted pumpkin butter oatmeal bars. This is not your typical granola bar recipe.
No, that's more like a cookie cake bar. The consistency is kind of a cross between a standard cookie and a cake, but, cookies and cookie bars were something that my mom and my grandma baked when I was growing up. And in fact, my mom just brought me a bunch of cookie bars the other day, and they didn't last very long in my house. But my grandma would always bake either cookies or the cookie bars right as school was getting out. So when I would spend days at her house after school waiting on mom and dad to get off work, that's the memory and the smell. You know, walking in the back door, you smell those cookies baking, and you know you've got a treat waiting for you when you get home from school. That's where that kind of originates from. And the recipe that I shared is just one of many that are out there and available, but it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, the smell of baking is one major reason why I love to bake. I wanted to ask you also about seasonal recipes. And I'm thinking this is a great time of year for summer fruit baking. I haven't had a chance. My sister
Absolutely.
Just brought me some blueberries from Michigan. I haven't had a chance to get there myself and get cherries because I have a great. I want to ask you about buckles, which I feel like is a good Midwestern summer fruit recipe. Are there others that you think is a great baking dessert for this time of year?
Here we have right now peaches. We're kind of in peach season. We're headed into apples. We start the summer, you know, late spring and summer with strawberries and kind of move through almost religiously by calendar, you know, by the month, what we can expect as far as fruit. Here we do a lot of crisps and crumbles,
mm-hmm.
Both of which are certainly very simple. We also do what we call dump cakes or dump recipes.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of like a buckle, I feel like, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it is. So different terms, different names probably in different parts of the country. But those are the two or three that are pretty popular here. We also, when apple season hits, apple pie, of course, fritters. I mean, there's all sorts of things, lots of fried things here in the southern part of the state, too.
Right. And well, it's an interesting thing when you think about, even if you don't use the term, because I feel like buckle, maybe that's a central northern Illinois, and then the further north you get to Midwest term, you don't use that term.
No, we don't. We don't. We're dump cake, cobbler, and crisps.
Mm-hmm.
Or what we use here, mm-hmm. and that's probably more southern. You know, we're a lot of the people who migrated and settled here came from what we call the upland south. They came through the Carolinas and up through Tennessee and Kentucky. So a lot of that southern food influence came with them, and we still have that here today strongly.
We are almost out of time, but since you mentioned that, I do want to mention, since you mentioned the South, you have a fried donut. It's basically fried
donut.
Biscuit dough. Is that also a popular family recipe that you had?
You know what, when I was a kid and a teenager, that I thought that was something that my mom made up, because we got hungry one night for donuts.
I always thought it was something my mom made up too.
Well, I have found that to be the case. So when I met my best friend in high school, she started talking about her mom's biscuit donuts. I'm like, wait, my mom does those. And come to find out that it was kind of the go-to budget-friendly, quick and easy dessert for a lot of moms. And it's still one of my favorites. And it's a 50-cent can of biscuits, and you cut them in half, and you fry them and coat them in cinnamon sugar. And it's that simple.
It is that simple.
So good.
And it's a good reminder for how simple and easy it is for us if we want to do some of these classic recipes. I want to thank Nikki Davis for being with us. We will tweet out Nikki's article and blog for The Southern. Her blog is called Rooted in Food. She also teaches at SIU. Nikki, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
That does it for us. We'll be back next week with live shows, our first live shows of the year. Stay tuned for that. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that for wherever you get your smartphone apps. It's a good way to find past shows. It's pretty simple to download. Then you can set your home station. And if you search for The 21st to follow us, it's an easy way to listen to past shows. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the hour with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. Our Facebook page, if you want to search for The 21st to like us, is another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Vishesh Anand, Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.